From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In his book, Berlin 1961, Frederick Kemp makes a controversial argument that the first year of President John F. Kennedy's term was one of the worst of any modern presidency. From the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, to weakness at the Vienna summit, to a de facto blessing to build the Berlin Wall, Kennedy showed inexperience, which his Soviet counterpart Nikita Khrushchev exploited, and Kemp argues amplified and extended the Cold War. Frederick Kemp is speaking at Westminster College tonight, and today on the program he joins us to talk about the education of a president and lessons from the Cold War. Plus, are machines making us stupid? Two Weber State University professors take a stab at answering the question. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. History, according to Frederick Kemp, has been kind to President John F. Kennedy. His inexperience and weakness during his first year in office, says Kemp, led directly to the Bay of Pigs showdown in the spring of 1961 and the erection of the Berlin Wall in the fall of that year. So what lessons can U.S. leaders today learn about this pivotal year in foreign policy? Today on the program, we're talking about lessons from the Cold War with my guest, Frederick Kemp. He's president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, a think tank which promotes U.S. leadership globally. Before that, he was a reporter, columnist, and editor for the Wall Street Journal. And before that, he was a journalism student at the University of Utah. And his fourth book, Berlin 1961, was published last year. Frederick Kemp joins me in studio. And Frederick Kemp, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Later on in the program, we're talking about the effect of technology on our intelligence. But first, Berlin 1961. If you have questions or comments about policies and politics of Nikita Khrushchev or John F. Kennedy during this pivotal year, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And I should mention that Frederick Kemp is speaking at Westminster College tonight at 7 o'clock here in Salt Lake City. More details on that as we go. Fred, before, as I mentioned, before any of your very overwhelming achievements, you were a journalism student here at the University of Utah. I understand that's actually where you began reporting on Germany. Tell us a little bit about that study abroad experience and really how that changed your view of the world.
Well, let me do a shout out here to my professor who's still here, Milt Holstein, University of Utah. You know, some professors change a lot of lives just through their energy, their intelligence and their enthusiasm for the students and their work, and he certainly did that for me. And then in the German department, Heinz Rade, who's sadly no longer alive, was that. So he captured my interest. My parents were German immigrants, so I was already interested in going abroad. There was an exchange program with a university in Kiel, Germany. And I got to know, while I was there, a group that was helping people escape from East Germany. So, A, I wrote a story that won national prizes on that. And, B, I went over and was strip-searched on my way across Checkpoint Charlie to visit my relatives in East Germany. And for the first time in my life, met people who didn't live in freedom. And that has a huge impact on a young man who wants to be a journalist. And so, from then on, I was lost to being a Cold Warrior and wanted to really understand why the Cold War had come to be and the forces that were shaping it.
Hmm. Why Berlin and why 1961? Why did you decide that this was a year that deserved extended examination?
I think that Berlin was the epicenter of the Cold War and 1961 was the most decisive year of the Cold War. So I really wanted to tell the story of that year. And though I, as a reporter, understood the forces that were behind the fall of the Berlin Wall, because I had reported it in 1989 and then unification, German unification in 1990, I didn't really know the forces that had brought about the construction of the Berlin Wall. What role did John F. Kennedy play? Could it have been prevented? Could we have spared tens of millions of people from a further generation of oppression under Soviet rule. So these were very big questions, and these were the questions I wanted to investigate.
Clearly, a tremendous amount of research went into this book. Talk about some of the newly declassified information that you were able to research and uncover while you were working on this project.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the most controversial point in the book and the one that's raised the most debate is my conclusion that 1961 was marked one of the worst foreign policy performances of any modern president, John F. Kennedy. Bay of Pigs, Vienna Summit, Berlin Wall, showdown of tanks at Checkpoint Charlie. So this was all crammed into the first year of the youngest president ever elected in America. And so what I was able to do is piece together the documents that really told that story and made one pretty convinced that not only was the story true, but even John F. Kennedy admitted to that story. When he was asked by the journalist Ellie Abel, the Detroit News bureau chief in Washington, whether he would cooperate in a book about his first year in office, Kennedy told Ellie Abel, who would want to read a book about an administration that has nothing to show for itself but a string of disasters? So what I really looked for were documents that either knocked down that narrative or documents that built that up. And I think that's where I found the most interesting sort of new documents, which are documents that really supported that story.
Set the scene for us in Berlin in 1961. It was a divided city as a result of the Potsdam Agreement at the end of World War II. Still a divided city when Kennedy came into office 15, 16 years later. What was the city? What were the tensions like? What was the environment of Berlin like in 1961?
It was a divided city, but what a lot of people forget is Berlin was an island floating in East Germany. So it wasn't on the border between East and West Germany. That border had already been shut down in 1953. And the border in Berlin, this free city floating inside of communist East Germany, was still open under four power rights. What that was creating was a hemorrhage of refugees. From 1945 to 1961, so the 16 years after World War II, you had 2.8 million refugees crossing from east to west. And after that, East Germany only had a population of 17 million people. So that's a huge part of their society, but the best doctors, the best farmers, the best teachers were going to the west. And as West Germany's economy grew stronger and comparatively East Germany's economy grew weaker, the flood of refugees in 61 was accelerating, threatening the implosion of the Soviet Empire. So that
was the strategic importance of this particular place.
It was the epicenter of the Cold War, and in 1961, East Germany threatened to implode, which could have had a knock-on effect of implosion of the Soviet bloc, and more importantly for Nikita Khrushchev, it could have cost him his political head.
Frederick Kemp, he is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council. He was formerly a reporter, an editor, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He is visiting Salt Lake City and will present the lecture From Kennedy to Obama, How Presidential Decisions Shape History and Foreign Policy, tonight at 7 o'clock at Westminster College. More information on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about 1961, about the strategic importance of Berlin, of the presidency of John F. Kennedy, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. At its heart, your book really seems to be a character study of two of the most important world leaders at the time, Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy. Give us a sketch of who these men were in 1961.
That gives the book so much of its interest is you could not have two more contrasting foils. John F. Kennedy, age 43, the product of privilege. Khrushchev, age 67, the product of poverty. Kennedy attends the best schools in America, Choate and then Harvard College. is brilliant, is the product of his father's ambitions. His brother Joe Jr. dies in war, and his father feeds all of his ambitions into his son. Khrushchev is the survivor of Stalin's purges, is the survivor of World War II, of all the post-war party struggles. So he's hardened, he's tough, but he was illiterate into his 20s. So very different characters. And what I think is important about understanding how different these characters are is that they had no real means of understanding each other. They didn't really get each other's backgrounds, motivations, and so the distrust and miscommunication began from day one.
And as you mentioned, Khrushchev, he may have been hardened and a survivor, but he still had some hard political realities at home to deal with.
He was much more of a reformer than was really understood by the Kennedy administration or America at that time. He denounced Joseph Stalin in his secret party speech, the 20th Party Congress speech in 1956. He called for peaceful coexistence with the West instead of inevitable conflict. These were all new moves. And I think our propaganda instead painted him and the Soviet Union as a country and person bent on world domination. But in 1961, as my book shows and demonstrates pretty strongly, he was most interested in domestic political survival. The big mistake I think presidents make, whether it's Obama now or whether it was Kennedy then, is to misunderstand that we have domestic politics. We expect our friends, our allies, our adversaries to understand that we have our elections and it shapes things. But we underestimate the impact of domestic politics on authoritarian regimes, whether it's today's Iran or whether it was the Soviet Union of that day. And Khrushchev was under attack from two sides. The Stalinist remnants, hardliners who thought he was too soft on the United States, and from Mao Zedong in China. And Mao at that time was challenging the Soviet control of the world communist movement.
So he had to worry about his political position at home as well as how he looked on the world stage. And that was why you think you argue that he acted the way he did, at first conciliatory and then very hardline.
I think it all starts at home. Domestic politics is what drives things more often than not. And in that year, he wanted to accommodate, come to some sort of accommodation with the United States over Berlin. He wanted peaceful coexistence, not because he loved the United States or capitalism, but because he saw his economic standing in the world needed a rest. He had to spend less on defense, and he had to get the Soviet economy going. He had visited the United States. He knew how far they were behind. But the moment he was not given the possibility of negotiating, moving things forward with Kennedy, he then had to go in a harder line direction just to save his own political skin.
John F. Kennedy, you mentioned son of privilege. Clearly, young, smart, charismatic, photogenic, all the things that we think of as Kennedy today. In your book, though, you reveal that there is a very steep learning curve when you become the president of the free world.
Yeah, it's my view that that the most dangerous moment for the United States is the first year of an untested, young, inexperienced president making a transition from another party. And then add on top of that a historic inflection point. So you have Kennedy coming in age 43, taking over for President Eisenhower age 70, so the youngest president in American history replacing the oldest president in American history. Eisenhower's been to war. He was commander of chief of troops of World War II. Kennedy comes in really believing he's the change agent. There's a lot of echo in the Obama campaign from the Kennedy time, but he's the change agent. He's going to make the world better. The power of his brilliance, the power of his personality, the power of his charm is going to move things along, and he runs face to face with the reality of how hard leadership is.
Even just a couple of days into his administration, he's faced with Khrushchev's decision to release some prisoners of war.
Yeah, Khrushchev had captured two sets of airmen during 1960, And he held on to them, and he wouldn't release them despite the Republican administration's efforts to get them released, because he didn't want to help Richard Nixon, who was Kennedy's opponent in the 1960 elections. He didn't want to help the Republican Richard Nixon get elected. That if he had released those airmen during 1960, it might have pushed Nixon over the top, and he might have won the election. So in many respects, Khrushchev believed he had won the election for President Kennedy, and he told his colleagues as much. Then on the day after the inauguration, he releases RB-47 airmen to Kennedy as a gesture. He also prints the entire inaugural address of Kennedy, first time a Soviet leader had ever done that for any American president. Kennedy, however, instead focuses on what he thought was a secret Khrushchev speech escalating the Cold War against him across the developing world. It turns out that it was just a routine propaganda speech that Khrushchev had delivered to fill in propagandists and party ideologists on the outcome of a party meeting the previous November. But based on that misunderstanding of a Khrushchev speech, Kennedy delivers an apocalyptic State of the Union speech that puts him more on a collision course with the Soviet Union, at a time when he probably should have been at least testing out these Khrushchev gestures. It was really the last moment of the Kennedy administration where he would have had a good chance to test out the gestures from Khrushchev and create a better relationship.
Hmm. Frederick Kemp, he is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, also the author of the book Berlin 1961. He'll be presenting the lecture From Kennedy to Obama, How Presidential Decisions Shape History and Foreign Policy. That's happening tonight at 7 o'clock at Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. For more information, you can go to our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about Berlin 1961, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. If history has taught us anything, it takes decades and more to see events 2020. And although it's only been 50 years since 1961, Frederick Kemp says the events of the Cold War are starting to come into focus. Today on the program, we're talking about lessons from that period of time, as well as his book, Berlin 1961. He's presenting the lecture From Kennedy to Obama, How Presidential Decisions Shape History and Foreign Policy tonight. We'll give you details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. 1961, in the book, you kind of map out some of the missteps of President Kennedy. And you begin with the Bay of Pigs invasion, of course, the failure to overthrow Cuba's Fidel Castro. Why do you blame Kennedy for this loss? Because really, the origins of this operation were hatched during the Eisenhower administration years before.
What was important for me about the Bay of Pigs, and a lot has been written about that, so I wasn't trying to retell the Bay of Pigs. What's important for me is how does the Soviet leader experience it? And what conclusions does he reach through it? And his intelligence had showed him that something was going to happen. And so he assumed the U.S. was going to act. He also knew that he really didn't have the means to do anything about it. What he was surprised by was that Kennedy neither canceled the operation that was hatched during the Eisenhower administration, CIA-backed rebels invading Cuba, nor did he give it the teeth to succeed. So a courageous presidential act in the view of Khrushchev would have been either canceling it altogether or giving it the teeth to succeed. And he says to his son, Sergei, I can't believe he's been so indecisive. He compares it unfavorably with his own decisive action in the bloody put down of the Hungarian uprising in 1956.
Mm-hmm. And Khrushchev has, as you note in the book, had been reaching out, had wanted to be meeting with Kennedy for quite some time. You note that another turning point for Kennedy came at the Vienna summit mid-year during 1961. What was the goal of the summit, and why do you see this as one of Kennedy's failures?
Well, let me first set up the summit, because what you were just talking about is absolutely crucial, which is Khrushchev badly wanted to meet with Kennedy, wanted to talk over Berlin, see if he could reach an accommodation. Khrushchev, from the very beginning of the year, is focused on the October Party Congress he's got at the end of the year. Again, domestic politics. He needs to fix Berlin or figure out what's going on in Berlin ahead of this Party Congress. He's ousted enemies at Party Congresses. He wants to make sure the same thing doesn't happen to him. As soon as Kennedy turns more aggressive after the misreading of the Khrushchev speech, Khrushchev backs off. And he no longer wants to come to a summit. He won't even receive the invitation from Kennedy to come to a summit. And then the Bay of Pigs happens. At the same time of the Bay of Pigs, Khrushchev puts the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. The momentum shifts. Khrushchev's got momentum, positive momentum. Kennedy's on his back feet, has become defensive over Bay of Pigs. At that point, Khrushchev says, sure, I'll meet you now. So 6 weeks after the Bay of Pigs, only 6 weeks after the Bay of Pigs, with very bad preparation, Kennedy comes to Vienna to meet Khrushchev in the summit. I think it's important to set that up, because you see little preparation for the summit, Kennedy in defensive situation, Khrushchev bombastic in the worst of times, of course, when he's got this much optimism and this much confidence coming in, thinking he's got Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you note that Khrushchev, Kennedy, wanted to send a message, though, that he was strong, that he was resilient, and he actually gave a second sort of State of the Union speech in May. So why do you think he didn't follow through with those tough words in Vienna and then again in Berlin in the fall?
Well, he spoke loudly and carried a small stick. I mean, that was the way his 61 went. At the Vienna summit, by his own account, Kennedy says he was savaged by Khrushchev. He calls it the worst day in his life. After the two-day summit, he takes aside the New York Times correspondent Scotty Resson and predicts that Khrushchev will now consider him weak, Bay of Pigs, Vienna summit, and will take some action in Berlin. It turns out, of course, to be prophetic. He had been told on the first day of the summit not to get into ideological debate with Khrushchev, and he did it anyway. He had thought he reached a pre-summit negotiation through a very interesting back channel that he built between his brother Bobby Kennedy and a Soviet military intelligence agent. He thought he had reached an agreement that Berlin would not play a big role in the summit. Instead, Khrushchev ambushes him with an ultimatum. So Kennedy is totally outmaneuvered and savaged. And it's at that point that Kennedy thinks he has to be more aggressive in his rhetoric. He does give a couple of speeches in those directions, but Khrushchev, coming away from Vienna, has already decided he can get away with closing the Berlin border without Kennedy responding.
So I guess the argument that you're presenting is that Kennedy was a victim of his own inexperience, that he did not follow the advice of some of his valued advisors, that he talked tough, but again, didn't follow through. And the result is the building of the Berlin Wall. Could Kennedy have reacted differently, do you think?
You know, presidents learn in office, and this was a bad year for Kennedy. We can talk about 62, 63, which get better. Obviously, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he finally stands up to the Soviets. But in this year, I think the big question and people who criticize the book say, well, what else could he have done? Could he have stopped the Berlin Wall from being built? Would it not have caused war to try to stop the Berlin Wall from being built? My argument is, if he had sent a tougher message in Vienna, essentially the same message that President Truman and President Eisenhower sent before him, which is, you don't change any of the four power rights in Berlin, we won't put up with it, then Khrushchev would have had to think twice ahead of his October Party Congress, of taking the risk of shutting down the Berlin border in August. Instead, what I argue is that Kennedy essentially writes the script for the construction of the Berlin Wall. And what I mean by that is in Vienna, he says, essentially, whatever you want to do within your own territory, East Berlin, Eastern Europe, is your business. If you don't touch the freedom of West Berlin or free access to West Berlin of allies and allied troops, it's up to you. And in many ways, Kennedy not only acquiesced to the building of the Berlin Wall, but he welcomed it because he thought it would reduce tensions with the Soviet Union so that he could do what he wanted to do, which is negotiate a nuclear test ban and arms control agreements with the Soviet Union, which he thought was much more important than whether or not Berlin remained entirely free.
And of course, we know it lasted for 28 years. You probably could never have known that. Frederick Kemp, he is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, author of the book Berlin 1961. He's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Westminster College. So I guess there are some understandable parallels between President Obama and President Kennedy. What are those correlations that you see in these two young presidents?
Well, first and foremost, and you said this at the beginning of the program, I believe, and I think the book demonstrates, that the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, where Kennedy turns out to be a hero, never would have happened if Khrushchev hadn't decided through Berlin in 1961 that Kennedy was weak and could be had. So presidents at historic inflection points have to be very careful about the messages that they send to adversaries and friends, because if they appear weak or if they appear to be disengaged, then you could see adversaries taking advantage. So there are two Obamas in this respect. One of them is the Obama who tracks down and kills Osama bin Laden. Decisive, presidential, risk-taking. And in many respects, you could view that as the Cuban Missile Crisis moment of the Obama administration, where he really saw that through the prudent use of force, he could support American interests abroad. There's another Obama, and that's the Obama who is watching Syria without really knowing what he can do about it. He's watching Iran develop nuclear weapons, realizing the perils of acting against it, not really knowing how to approach it. I think the lesson of the Kennedy administration, it's not that he has to go to war about Iran. It's not that he has to go to war about Syria. It's that you need consistent, clear messages to your adversaries and your friends so they actually know what you're willing to do, what you're not willing to do, so that people don't inadvertently get into a war situation through misreading American signals.
I guess one difference, though, now is that Kennedy had a very clear adversary in Nikita Khrushchev. I'm sure that Mao in China presented some challenges, too, but, I mean, that was clearly defined, whereas President Obama, not so clear. I mean, there are very, very volatile areas throughout the world right now.
President Obama comes into office, even though he's 4 years older than Kennedy, with far less experience than Kennedy. So he's even less experienced when he comes into office than Kennedy. He has to deal with an economic crisis, et cetera, et cetera. I think the big difference between Kennedy's days and now is in Kennedy's days, the strategy was clear. Containing the Soviet Union, avoiding nuclear war. But the tactics were difficult. What do you do about the Berlin Wall? What do you do about Cuba? In Obama's presidency, it's all about tactics. And it seems to me that the presidency is still looking for strategy in a much more complex world, many more dangers all over the world, but a much less perilous world in the sense that there isn't the real danger of nuclear holocaust or nuclear exchange between major powers.
Even with Iran
hasn't developed nuclear weapons yet. Even if it develops nuclear weapons, it's hardly a great power, and we're not going to get in a great power struggle with it. So the risks are far lower, but the risk of something happening is far higher. So the overall risk of what would happen if something broke out into war is relatively low compared to U.S.-Soviet period. What's really interesting to me, looking at the comparison between the two men, one the first Catholic president in history, the other the first African-American president in history. Both of them reflective presidents rather than instinctive presidents. I think Truman and Reagan were more instinctive presidents. Is that both were determined from the day they got into office to be great presidents in history. But I think with Obama, he's aiming much more at a domestic story. He wants to remake America domestically, and the foreign policy decisions he makes, Afghanistan, Iraq, others, fit into that. He wants to create space for himself and create funding for himself to fix the problems of America. For Kennedy, certainly he was looking at the civil rights issues and different issues, but he knew his presidency was going to be about the U.S.-Soviet relationship.
So what lessons can we learn from this particular year? What do you hope that readers will take away from this book and from what you have to say about the relationship between 1961 and today?
No human being on earth is equipped to be president of the United States. I mean, the talents this takes, the instincts this takes, the training this takes, you just can't do it. So every president is going to fail in some way.
And yet those decisions are so crucial, even the small ones.
People are playing match point on day one of the presidency, and they haven't learned the tennis game yet. So I think the lesson is that a second term is most often better than the first, because the learning curve for very intelligent people like Kennedy and Obama is great. Kennedy in 1962 made tougher decisions of the sort he should have done in 61. Then 1963 he gives his famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech in Berlin. So you see the growth of President Kennedy. Obama, as of end November, was already president longer than Kennedy. Kennedy served only 3 years. We'll never know what kind of president Kennedy would have been into a second term. One may get that experience with Obama. And right now, what Obama's all about is getting reelected, because he knows you can't be a great president, hard to be a great president, without being reelected. So his focus isn't so much on Iran or anything else. His focus is on getting reelected.
And is that and a good, is that a wise move, though, learning from Kennedy's experience?
I think the most important thing that Obama can learn from Kennedy's experience is brilliance and charm isn't enough. And Kennedy thought through engagement through the Soviet Union, through accepting, acquiescing to the Berlin Wall, he was going to get better behavior from the Soviet Union. Obama is focusing on engaging with Iran, engaging with Russia, engaging with China. There are moments when you actually have to stand up and say, don't step over this line. And I think the lesson from the Kennedy administration is Kennedy did learn that, and that he got better results once he understood that you had to engage, but you also had to draw clear lines.
Frederick Kemp, he's president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, also author of the book Berlin 1961. He'll be presenting the lecture From Kennedy to Obama, How Presidential Decisions Shape History and Foreign Policy. That's happening tonight at 7 at Westminster College in the Vive Gore Concert Hall. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. And Fred Kemp, thanks very much for your time today.
Enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Up next, how technology is changing the way we think. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Facebook, iPhones, constant connectivity are a fact of modern life. But does technology and the omnipresent media really enrich our relationships, boost our moods, enhance our intellectual capacity, or is the opposite true? Are machines making us stupid? That's the title of a class taught at Weber State University by my guest, Susan Matt. She's a professor and chair of the history department at Weber State University. And Susan Matt, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Luke Fernandez, Manager of Program and Technology Development at Weber. And Luke, thanks to you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me too.
They teach the course along with the English professor, Scott Rogers, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? And they joined me in studio. Do you think the internet is changing the way you read, write, or even think? give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Your syllabus says you are looking at how technology affects our inner lives and how everyday people cope with it. What got you interested in this topic, first of all, Luke Fernandez?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I'm a developer of software technology at Weber State, and I subscribed to a CIO listserv. And on the CIO listserv, there was a CIO asking, how can we increase connectivity on campus, which is an initiative that lots of campuses are engaged in. And what I was asking on that CIO listserv was, well, are there times when we also want to disconnect? Because there's a lot of faculty who in their classrooms see the intrusion of technologies as intrusive, as interruptive. Do we need classrooms that have sort of ways of disconnecting from the internet? And one of the CIOs suggested, well, put in a Faraday cage, which is, not everyone knows what a Faraday cage is, but it's a lead-lined room in which electromagnetic waves are prevented from entering, so that you can keep people on your class on task and sort of focused without having the distractions of the internet at hand. Unfortunately, that sort of technological solution is pretty impractical. It costs a lot of money to build those sorts of rooms. So based on that sort of problem, I proposed to the National Endowment of the Humanities that we develop some software that could perhaps do something comparable. And so what we're doing is we're repurposing some testing centers on campus and having our students go in there and write their assignments in those particular contexts, and we can moderate the level of connectivity that they have vis-a-vis the web. So on this upcoming assignment, they have some limited connectivity to the web, but fairly limited. And on the next assignment, we'll probably vary that. And based on these sort of different contexts, writing contexts in which sometimes they have complete access and sometimes limited contexts, we want the students to explore the extent to which these different contexts help improve their ability to write or degrade it.
I'm sure you read this piece a number of years ago in The Atlantic by the tech writer Nicholas Carr. It's titled, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And he complained that the internet seems to be chipping away at my capacity for concentration and contemplation. Is that what got you involved in this project, Susan Matt? I mean, do you feel that sort of the distraction is impeding your scholarship?
Absolutely. It used to be much easier to go into a library with a pad of paper and not even know what was going on in the news. And when I switched to a laptop for a while, that worked. But then I got wireless, and email announcements alert me that I've got incoming mail, and I could check my Facebook. And it's a lot harder to close off the rest of the world, but I think that's necessary. And in our class, there are a range of opinions between the three of us, and I think I'm probably the most pessimistic about what technology is doing to us. I really feel like it's intruding on concentration, eating away at our ability to focus, and making it a lot harder to get good work done.
Well, we'll get to some of those opinions and conclusions in a minute, but as a historian, I mean, is this a new problem, or have we as humans worried about the effect of technology on our lives, on our relationships before? Is this a familiar tune?
It is a familiar tune. People worried about the telephone, that the telephone would bring in intrusions and strangers into the household and
it
ruin
kind of
your
did.
Quiet time. It's true. And the same about television. We are assigning articles about people's reactions to radio, and there were all these debates in the 1930s. Should you allow radio on campus? Maybe that was going to distract people. So I think there are recurrent worries. Just because they existed in the past doesn't mean we don't need to worry today, though, as well. I think each generation has to figure out how to adopt its technology most wisely.
Well, I guess that is part of the question, though. How is today different? If the radio was going to bring ruin to our world as we knew it, it didn't. At least I hope not, because we're here today talking on the radio. But if these are old questions and recurrent themes, how is today different? Luke Fernandez.
Well, you know, it's funny. You're asking the person who's not trained as the professional historian to answer this. So I'm learning a lot in this course. And one of the words that is new to me, but I think helps to sort of shed light on this, is the concept of chronocentrism, which is similar. You know, we're familiar with words like ethnocentrism ethnocentrism, you know, which is sort of centered on one's own culture. Well, similarly, chronocentrism is the feeling that our own present day is somehow unique. That it's different from other eras, and that somehow technology and change is accelerating and happening more quickly now than it ever was. But the irony, or the paradox, I think, as Susan would tell you as the historian, is that the people in the 19th century were feeling very similarly. That is a good question. If every era feels the same way, are we really different? I think and so in some ways we're not. If you sort of are. Take exception to the idea of chronocentrism. But on the other hand, you know, I think there are, arguably we are, technology is changing and the world is changing much more rapidly now, and that there is a certain urgency now that there wasn't in the past. But that doesn't mean to say that past eras didn't also feel that there was urgency in their own times.
Do you, Susan, Matt, do you see our current predicament as somehow uniquely different from what we've experienced time and again through history?
Well, I think it's different in the details, in the speed of connectivity. I think it's similar in some other ways, however. In fact, today in class, after we leave here, we're going to be talking about the telegraph. And in the 19th century, people said the telegraph was going to be the nerve of international life. And they were just amazed that you could have the news 2 hours later from London. And they were blown away by the speed of life and how it had picked up. So it is all relative. I think our differences may be differences of degree rather than differences of kind between the generations.
We're speaking with Susan Matt, a professor and chair of the history department at Weber State University. Also with us, Luke Fernandez, manager of program and technology development at Weber. And they teach a course along with the English professor, Scott Rogers, titled, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? If you'd like to chime in on the conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You're coming from the humanities. I don't see a hard scientist among you, but I'm wondering if there's any evidence other than the anecdotal, just this feeling that we're constantly getting interrupted and distracted. Is there any research that shows that technology is in some way rewiring our brains or the way that we approach work or the way that we're able to think very deeply about a subject? Luke?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and Nicholas Carr, you know, you referred to him earlier, the article he had in Atlantic earlier. There is a certain extent to which our brains have a certain degree of plasticity built in, so that our technologies, we're not just as human beings using tools, but they're in turn shaping the way we think about the world. So there's a certain degree of plasticity. But, this radio station is located right adjacent to the Leonardo Museum. And on the second floor of the Leonardo Museum, there's an exhibit, not just an exhibit, but a lab that people here in Salt Lake can go into and take a multitasking test. And it's being run by a faculty member in the psychology department up at Utah, at the University of Utah. And the findings there are that only about 2 or 3%, as my understanding, is that only 2 or 3% of the public are actually multitasking people, which presents an interesting conundrum because arguably a lot of our technologies, all of these technologies, while they have many virtues about being able to make us more connected, they also interrupt our abilities to proceed with one task without being interrupted by another. If we're not multitasking people, and if there's limits to how plastic our brains is and how much we can adjust to our new tools, maybe there's a concern here.
Are students today worried about this? I mean, they grew up in a time when they were practically connected to the internet at birth, you know? Old schoolers like me, I mean, we didn't really embrace computers until high school. But I think people today, I mean, I see little kids in a restaurant, you know, toddlers playing around with an iPhone. I'm curious what your students think about this topic. Are they even worried about it? Luke Fernandez?
You know, I don't think it's a simple generational divide. I think we're seeing in our own class, we just did an informal survey at the beginning of the class, and there's 27 people in the class. And naturally, it's a self-selected bunch who probably are taking the course partly because they have a concerns about this. So what are some of the statistics we found there? I think we asked students, well, you know, if you had all the students sometimes have a pretty limited income. So we asked them, you know, if you had enough money to spare, would you buy yourself a mobile phone, an iPhone? And the majority of the class did. But then when we also asked them, you know, are your technologies making you too connected with the world? Would you like a space of remove in which you're separated when you have a chance to reflect and sort of engage in single task? They said they wanted that as well. So there sort of are, I guess to answer your question, there seem to be multivalent instincts at work among all generations with respect to that, mm-hmm. that question.
Susan, Matt?
And even among our students, when we talk with them, some are adamant that this is just an issue of self-control, and if you can turn off the device, you should be fine and there are no problems. And others are much more worried about whether they have that self-control and whether there's something kind of addictive and seductive about the technology. So we see it even among people who are the same age, that some are pretty worried and some are pretty unconcerned.
But to do the kind of scholarship and research that can you do that? Can you multitask and think those deep thoughts? I mean, can you do the research while texting? You know what I'm saying? Susan, Matt.
We just had our first assignment where the students were disconnected from Facebook, from email, and had to write in the concentration lab that Luke built. And while the papers are still kind of trickling in, the first student to answer the essay question, just sitting there with nothing else, said this was much easier and it went a lot more quickly than if I'd been doing it at home with my cell phone, with my Facebook on. We've had previous assignments where we have let students be as connected as they wanted to be, and one of them quite frankly said, in the course of writing this page, I've texted my girlfriend 5 times and she's texted me back 5 times. So they're aware of the problem, but they don't seem to be able to rein it in either.
But as professors, have you noticed a qualitative difference in the research? And we won't name any student names out there, but if you are being interrupted consistently by texting, or, you know, this compelling need to check your email, is that hampering your ability or the level of deep thinking? Susan, Matt.
There are some students who are just terrific and could measure up to any generation students. And then there are some where things do seem choppy. And the Frontline documentary, Digital Nation, talked about how this generation thinks in paragraphs because that's about all you can get out before, you know, a Facebook update happens. So I don't know if I've gathered data systematically enough to say, you know, 10 years ago it was a lot better, but I think others are clued into that.
I noticed that on your syllabus you reference a TED Talk by Clay Shirky, who writes the social and economic benefits of the Internet. In this talk, he talks about the huge information overload, but we have there's a compelling need to filter out certain things. What are you hoping that students learn from that particular thought process, Luke?
Yeah, I think I don't know if I can give justice to Clay Shirky's TED Talk, which is, you know, 20 minutes long, but I think the basic thesis is that in the 20th century, with media technologies, all of the filtering was done by the media companies. The large media companies, you know, you sat down and you watched TV, and Ted Koppel or the announcers then decided what was the important news of the day, and you listened to it. In the 21st century, though, we've in many ways democratized our technologies. There's many more sort of messages that you can listen to, and so there isn't big media companies filtering out the message for you, and so then it's incumbent upon each of us as individuals to do that filtering for ourselves. And I think that's part of what we're trying to get our students and ourselves to to grasp is what are the most effective filters that we need to put in place since somebody isn't doing that for us now.
Your class is titled, Are Machines Making Us Stupid? Are you expecting to answer that question, or are you hoping that students will leave with more questions than answers? Susan, Matt?
I think it's the latter. We ourselves don't have a definitive answer, and I probably would be one who would say, yeah, they are making us stupid. I think Luke would probably say, no, they're not. And Scott would be someplace in between. But, you know, we want our students to consider a whole range of questions. Are machines making us stupid? Are they making us antisocial or more social? Are they depoliticizing us or rousing us to more political action? Are they teaching us how to connect across nations, or are they just leaving us into our own insular world where we choose what we want to look at and ignore things that contradict it? So it's a whole range of questions, and we, as you say, won't have an answer, but our hope is that as students go forward, they'll have kind of the critical tools and analyses to go and question themselves as they're moving through the digital world.
Mm-hmm. Susan Matt, professor and chair of the history department at Weber State University. Susan, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Luke Fernandez, manager of program and technology development at Weber State University. Luke, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
They teach a course along with the English professor Scott Rogers titled Are Machines Making Us Stupid? They joined me in studio here in Salt Lake City. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake, thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Also follow us on Facebook and Twitter for those technical-minded among you. Next time, women and college, and why so many Utah students who are women don't graduate. We'll have that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.